Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In the making, the state's Fish and Game Department recently released its new Wildlife Action Plan. This hefty document is an effort to describe the latest threats to all kinds of species, from bald eagles to butterflies. It also lists more than 100 actions that Granite Staters could take to ease these threats. Some are easy, for example, planting more shrubs in your backyard to create a cozy habitat for birds or rabbits. Others are much more involved, even controversial, from removing dams to avoiding herbicides and pesticides to not cutting down certain forests. The report is required by the federal government for state agencies like Fish and Game to access federal funding. But more broadly, it's meant as a guide for New Hampshire landowners, planners, developers, regular folk. There's no rules or regs involved. Instead, the report suggests how to, in its words, support a growing population and economy while maintaining the overall health of wildlife and its habitat. Today in The Exchange, what's up with New Hampshire wildlife? Let's hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests were all involved in this new wildlife action plan. With us in studio, John Cantor, Supervisor of Non-Game and Endangered Wildlife at New Hampshire Fish and Game. And John, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And also with us, Amanda Stone, Specialist in Land and Water Conservation at UNH Cooperative Extension. Amanda, welcome. Thank you.
Happy to be here.
And also with us, Nick Coates, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Association of Conservation Commissions and a former planner with Central New Hampshire Regional Planning Commission. And Nick Coates, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Well, all of you, but I'll start with you first, John Cantor. Just lay out for us, if you could please, what this report covers and what it doesn't cover.
What it does cover is the breadth of all wildlife native to New Hampshire, and it takes a look at what the conditions of their populations are. It takes a look at the habitats of New Hampshire and what the conditions of those habitats are. And then it lays out actions that people can take for the continued conservation of our native wildlife, which we know is so important. We're not just the scenic backdrop. We're also important habitats for some of the biodiversity of the world.
So native species. So what wouldn't be included in that, John? Like, are possums native to New Hampshire? Well, I think of them as invaders, but I don't know.
Yeah, I guess they would be an expanding, you know, into New Hampshire. They didn't occur here previously, but they don't seem to have the role of an invasive species. They just kind of have their own niche out there.
And you're also not talking in this report about, you know, hunting quotas and so forth.
No. This is about conservation strategies for the whole breadth of wildlife, everything from bumblebees right on up through bald eagles. So.
And a lot of focus on habitat and more than 100 actions that you would like to see people take to help preserve that habitat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, this is not New Hampshire Fish and Game's Wildlife Action Plan. This is New Hampshire's Wildlife Action Plan. And that's why we involve so many partners and people. We had stakeholder meetings all around the state to invite people in to hear what they want. To see their natural world and wildlife.
Well, and Amanda Stone, give us the elevator pitch, if you could. I mean, why is this sort of giant report so important?
Well, this is just an incredible, valuable body of information about wildlife and habitats that we have for communities and landowners and conservation groups to use in their conservation planning when they're working to protect their natural resources in their communities. It's very accessible information. We've made it accessible via our websites and distilling the Wildlife Action Plan down into various segments that they can take a look at. So there's a very, it's a lot of very practical, actionable information. And we help people to sort of see how they can take that information and put it into on-the-ground actions in their communities.
Well, and that's interesting. So give us an example, Amanda, of what you're talking about. If the average person listening says, you know, sure, I care about New Hampshire wildlife, but, you know, I live near downtown Concord and I have a little backyard. So,
right.
You know, what can I contribute to that?
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. There are many larger landowners who own several hundred acres who can manage their lands for wildlife habitat. But then you say, well, what can I do with maybe just an acre or two? And we have a great story on our website of a landowner who has landscaped his yard to make it more wildlife friendly. So there's sections of his yard that he doesn't mow, that he lets the grasses and the wildflowers grow up, a section of his yard that he allows to have shrubs, et cetera, berry-producing shrubs that are food-producing for wildlife. So there's many of those kinds of actions that individuals can take to make their yards more wildlife friendly.
And Nick Coates, I want to just draw on your past experience as a regional planner, in addition to your current role with the conservation commissions. Let us shine a light for us, if you could, Nick, on just kind of how this works. You know, someone wants to build a shopping mall or a housing development. What are some of the factors that have to come into play, especially in terms of, you know, how it affects the habitat and conservation?
So my members are conservation commissions, and they were established by state statute in, about 50 years ago, and they were specifically established to protect natural resources in the community and, more importantly, to identify the proper utilization of natural resources. So that's much different than protection. So there's a balancing act just within the RSA, to the law, to say where are the most appropriate places to have development, where are the most appropriate places to have natural resources that are protected. And so it's really the charge of my members to really start to identify where those locations are, where there can be development that's suitable for the community that doesn't turn a community into a suburban sprawl, if you will. And so there's a balancing act. And I think people of New Hampshire are always looking for that balancing act between too much development, not enough development, places to hike, clean water. And so the Conservation Commission's role is to help advise and help identify places where those things can happen.
So let's say I'm a builder, Nick, and I want to build an affordable housing project, 10 units, just picking a number out of the air. So many people say that this is a huge problem in New Hampshire, that we need more sort of affordable housing, smaller housing for folks. How would you balance the need for that against the need to preserve certain spaces or keep the water clean so there's not a lot of runoff? I mean, how would you decide what's appropriate and what isn't?
Well, we advise the conservation commissions often to look at the Wildlife Action Plan to identify what are the highest priority resources, either at the local level, the regional level, or at the state level. Those are places that they should start to say, does it make the most sense to have development here, yes or no? And if not, then where are the more appropriate places? And what I think is important to make the point is that conservation and development are not opposing forces. So you see
communities. Now, that's interesting because people often propose it that way. Yeah.
So I think what's important is that we, again, we look at balance. And you look at some communities who are doing some really innovative things that I think are starting to crop up, things like conservation subdivisions. So you co-locate housing and conservation. So you really get the most, in many ways, get the best of both worlds if you can. There are challenges, obviously, with communities in that. But it's not an opposing force to be able to do that and to think about things innovatively. And I think also what's important is that when communities are making decisions about development, that they should be thinking about how the conservation fits within the mix of their community. So how much is too much? How much is too little? is this resource, is this water resource really important to development? I think it is. I think clean water is what developers are looking for. So they have a role in that.
So build the housing development, but maybe not right next to the river.
Correct.
What do you think about this, John?
I think that by having information about, you know, where special resource, where is, you know, that threatened or endangered species, you know, what's the, where's that critical habitat for that species and stuff. When you have that information available to you, then you can work the plan around it. And I think what we're talking about here, a portion of the Wildlife Action Plan process is the production of maps showing habitat and kind of tiering it in, you know, in the highest significance. So for example, something that that contained one of the last populations, a New England cottontail, would get ranked very high, you know, compared to a similar patch of shrubland, you know, two towns over or something. So when you have the information available and you have it mapped to plan with, you know, I think that that's just a very essential part of it.
What do you think about what Nick says, John, this sort of, well, a shift in thinking, he seems to be saying, is needed, that it isn't either or, conservation or development. Remember in the 90s out in the Pacific Northwest, owls versus jobs. Remember that, the effort to save the spotted owl out there. How do you feel about that that type of thinking? And where does this action plan fit?
Yeah, I think you know, it's interesting because I've never experienced that, maybe that kind of, you know, kind of controversial, you know, headbutting as much. Maybe it's the New Hampshire way of kind of working together. I think a lot of times when we're approached, you know, there is permitting involved with getting wetlands permits and such, doing development. And during that process, you know, there is a check as to whether or not there are rare species there. But that's to start a conversation. And I think nowadays, you know, many developers or, you know, the Department of Transportation, they know that there are going to be these resources to consider. And so, you know, it's just the start of a conversation about and so you put smart people in a room together to, you know, to work out where the road should go versus the rare habitat. And I see that happen just as a matter of course as opposed to a matter of regulation these days more and more.
Amanda, do you want to jump in?
Yeah. And, you know, looking at the bigger picture with the maps that we have, that is something that is used a lot by New Hampshire communities and conservation groups in their planning. And what that helps them to do is to figure out where the most important areas in town are to protect. You can't protect everything. You've got to decide where are your priorities, what is important to protect, and then you can figure out, if that's what we've got to protect, where are the best places to develop? And I think that's what communities need to be looking at. So in terms of getting that balancing act, it's what should we protect in terms of our natural resources, whether it's wildlife habitat, water resources, et cetera, and then where is development best situated? And I think that's how they can try to work towards that kind of balance.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're looking at the state's new 10-year wildlife action plan and some of the actions within that plan recommended to better protect wildlife habitat. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. By the way, I know a lot of our listeners are thinking today about this latest mass shooting in California. I want to let everybody know we are going to be following up on that story on our show, of course, next week, and the larger issue of gun violence. So I want to let everyone know that we are definitely going to be following up on that. You can join us right now in our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. You know, some definitions, John, that I would like to just get out of the way before we get into some of the specifics. Federally endangered, New Hampshire endangered, federally threatened, New Hampshire threatened. What do all these mean?
Well, there are two different pieces of legislation here. There's this New Hampshire's Endangered Species Conservation Act, which allows the state to recognize species that are becoming rare or are rare in this state, are special to New Hampshire, and provide them with protection. And then at the national scale is the federal act. So you may have something that's doing poorly here in New Hampshire that overall may be in better shape.
So, I see.
So that's New Hampshire may list that, and that may help prevent the need for it to reach the federal list in the future. So I guess as a matter of scales, a state threatened species is the least, you know, closest to extinction. Endangered, you know, could mean it's about ready to disappear from New Hampshire. At the federal level, threatened, you know, same lesser category. Endangered means that it's in danger of disappearing from the country.
And John, just give us a couple. I mean, we could spend all day talking about all the species in this report, but just give us a couple of the ones that stand out for you that are either endangered or threatened.
I'll use a Karner blue butterfly, I think, is an example. You know, they are federally endangered species, and New Hampshire has the last remaining New England population. And
here in Concord, I believe.
Right here,
right?
In Concord,
yeah.
Yep. On up around the Concord Municipal Airport. And then a state endangered species is the Blanding's turtle, where New Hampshire has 40% of the Northeast population right here. So you might kind of say, well, why is it endangered? Well, there's a lot of them, relatively speaking, in New Hampshire, but this is where they occur. And so what we do to protect them influences their population overall throughout the country.
So what we do in New Hampshire matters, because if they can thrive here, they might procreate and spread to other regions of the country?
And if we put in place measures to protect and secure them here, then, you know, they're not – they're going to thrive into the future or be sustained into the future. And so they can kind of check that off the list of concern at the national level as well.
I have to ask you all about two other species that jumped out at me from this report. Nick, I think I'll turn to you next. The eastern wolf. I thought it was still up for debate that we even had wolves here.
I would defer
you
to John.
You want to throw that to John.
That.
Okay.
Yeah. So here it is. They call it Canis supus. Canis, you know, being the genus of wolf-like animals. Gray wolves, coyotes, and now we know there was a third species, eastern wolf. And they're all in this mix. They interbreed. What we have here now in New Hampshire is a coyote, which has a lot of genes of the eastern wolf, which occurs very rarely, kind of in Canada. Now, I shouldn't say very rarely, but its last populations are much less widespread than they used to be. So what we have is, I think the thought was there was a gray wolf here. There wasn't. There was an eastern wolf, a third species of canid that was here. And that's where we are right now in the scientific understanding of what occurred here historically and what could return to this part of the world.
All right. Well, that was one that jumped out at me. There's a couple of others, but let's go to our listeners again. The number 1-800-892-6477 in Wilton. Serafin is on the air. Hi, Serafin. Go ahead.
Hello. I was calling to ask this question. Wilton used to have a program called Keeping Track. We were very active in that, and that had to do with wildlife habitat and wildlife transit trails. And our Conservation Commission president went to another town, and I was wondering if this is something that conservation groups are doing all over the state.
Do you want to jump in on that, Nick? Thank you, Serafin, for calling in.
Sure, yes. Actually, one of the things that we do at our organization is we're really trying to focus on conservation commissions working more closely with the public and trying to engage people in the land, because when people are engaged in the land, then they're going to care for it and they're going to want to protect it and they're going to want to conserve it. So things like Keeping Track are happening around the state, and we see some really nice work in some communities about engaging young people, so kids. Specifically, and kids love getting out and pointing out. I know I have a son that loves this stuff, so I think it's a great program and people can definitely get involved in it.
Serafin, thanks a lot for the call. You can join us too after a short break. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More on New Hampshire's new 10-year wildlife action plan in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look at the state's new 10-year wildlife action plan. We want you to call in at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Your questions and comments about what this wildlife action plan entails, including some of the recommendations it makes about how communities could better plan for protecting wildlife habitat. 1-800-892-6477 again is our number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. A couple emails have come in. I want to share these with you. Here's one from Michelle who says, as we speak, the town of Hampton Falls is trapping and killing beavers because they did what beavers do. They made a dam on a marsh. The water is near a quiet residential road, which I live. My husband and I own much of the surrounding property. We were enjoying watching the beavers, and it is devastating to see them hauled out of the water dead. Is there no protection for the beavers? Michelle, thank you very much. And this brings up a couple issues, folks, not just specific to the beavers, but that water is a big issue, a big threat to wildlife habitat conservation. Do you want to jump in, John, very quickly on the issue of beavers specifically? And then I might ask you, Amanda, about water and some of the concerns around there.
Yes. Beaver, like some other species that are trapped, are protected and do have regulated seasons. However, where they are doing damage, where there is the potential for, you know, their activity to flood a road, you will often see, you know, folks will ask what are their certified wildlife control operators to come in and to trap and remove them in those situations. There are alternatives, and those alternatives, you know, are these what are called beaver deceivers, you know, ways to be able to get the water level to where you need it or want it. By tricking the beavers in, and they can't find the leak because it's a pipe system that goes through their dam.
You're trying to outsmart the beavers.
Outsmart the beavers
because they're pretty good water engineers.
They certainly are, and there are these techniques that have been proven to work. There's an like anything like that. There's initial outlay and expense, and they don't always work. So you know there's not a one size fits all solution. To that. But there are alternatives, and they should always be looked at because the wetlands that beavers create by impounding slow-moving streams are extremely valuable habitats for lots of different wildlife.
I see. Well, that's a really interesting email, Michelle, because it does bring up sort of you want to let the beavers do what they do. But on the other hand, if they're flooding the road twice a year, that's a problem. Nick, what do you think?
I was just going to add to that we did a workshop last year called Learning to Live with Beavers.
Oh,
in Merrimack, so they've done a very good job of planning through this process of how do we coexist. The town of Milford as well has done that. So there are ways to manage both habitat and behavior in a way that people and beavers can live together.
Well, and to you, a broader question, Amanda. The issue of water comes up again and again and again in this report. Can you just broadly describe why water is such a concern when it comes to habitat and wildlife protection?
Right. Well, you know, we have a very rich landscape in context of lakes and ponds and rivers throughout the state. And, you know, people tend to think when they're thinking of wildlife habitat, they're often thinking of wildlife on lands. But the water habitats are really very important for a number of species. Rivers in particular, rivers and streams provide valuable migratory corridors for wildlife during the migration seasons. They provide important habitat just for regular travel corridors moving between habitats. And then the wildlife that are actually in the water, the aquatic species that are in the water on our lakes and ponds. People love watching loons here in New Hampshire, New England. And, you know, there's a lot of great species that are out there on the water as well as on the land. And then you've got species that use that interface between water and land that's really important for feeding habitat, for breeding habitat, for cover and protection. So while water is important, it's often that interaction between water and land that is so important for wildlife habitat as well.
What are some of the threats that we're seeing now in terms of our water quality and the ability of wildlife to, you know,
right,
thrive on the water?
Development. It's development. And, you know, where there are interruptions to the hydrology of the rivers and streams, say through a culvert, a road crossing, maybe there's inadequately sized culverts, then wildlife are not able to move safely through that water body. We see road kills as a result. So it's again, it's that conflict between our developed environment and the natural environment out there. So you sort of see those conflicts coming in terms of water resources. So pollution is an issue because as we develop more, we have more pollution. As we get more bigger, more significant storms, we have a lot of runoff. We have a lot of impervious surfaces where the water can't infiltrate anymore. So we're seeing a lot of those kinds of changes. And so protecting wildlife habitat, we need to also protect our water resources because it's all part of that, preserving water quality and water quantity for our water supplies.
Well, and I want to ask both of you as well about some of the water issues because they get a lot of attention in this report from rivers, culverts, dams, salt marshes. But first, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Kevin Smith is with us. He's the Londonderry Town Manager, a community which has looked at this broader question that we're looking at in terms of development and animal habitat. Kevin Smith, welcome back to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Laura, thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be back.
Well, and just real broadly, Kevin, what are the factors that a town like yours has to weigh when considering a new development if there's concern about that development disrupting wildlife?
Sure. Well, I think it's all about, you know, striking a balance. And in Londonderry, I think we've gone a long ways to do a good job of that. I would start by noting that approximately 25 to 30% of Londonderry's land mass has been set aside in open space or conservation over the last 30 years or so. So we have a pretty good sized portion of our land that is it will never be developed. And portions of this conservation land have also been set aside for these habitats for some of these potentially endangered species like the New England cottontail, the hognose snake. And in one area where we've been dealing with this as of late is a lot of the developable land up and around the airport area. And so what we were able to do is in working with the developers and the state of New Hampshire is the developers and builders of many of the projects up there paid a mitigation fee, if you will, to New Hampshire Fish and Game that go towards working to preserve habitats in the area and setting aside land that cannot be developed in that particular corridor as well. And this has gone a long way in satisfying the federal officials from putting it on, particularly the New England cottontail, on the endangered species list, as they're seeing that both the state and the town are being proactive in saying, well, we want a balance of both development in the town, you know, to create jobs and help the economy, but at the same time to make sure that we're not completely displacing the habitats that may exist in these particular areas.
Yeah, and it's particularly interesting in Londonderry, I think, Kevin, because you're sort of a bustling town, a bedroom
sure.
community of Manchester and to some extent Boston. And so there's some growth and development there. On the other hand, people in Londonderry, it seems to me, like the idea that they're living in a pretty place. So it's tough.
Absolutely. But, you know, I often like to show people the maps in my office when they come in so I can show them exactly where Londonderry has designated its commercial and industrial corridors. And the town has more or less said, in these particular corridors, we want the highest and best uses, and we want to create jobs, and we want economic activity. But you also see mostly a giant green and white space on the map, and those are the areas where the town has said, we want to preserve these areas. We want to make sure that these areas remain pristine, they go untouched, and they're never developed. And I think it'd be hard-pressed to find many communities, especially in southern New Hampshire, that have been able to strike that balance between having both development but also having a pretty sizable portion of their land set aside for conservation and some of these endangered species habitats.
Londonderry, from what I understand, Kevin, dealt with this issue just last fall when Fish and Game wanted to preserve rabbit habitat behind
Correct.
A school. So what happened?
Yeah, so what Fish and Game did is they came to us and said, look, we're looking to partner with the town in being able to manage some of the conservation land that has already been set aside. So that we can, again, show the federal government that we're doing our part to make sure that we're preserving habitats for these potentially endangered species. And the town was very willing to work with Fish and Game and allow them to manage these areas that have been set aside for conservation and to partner with them to do this. And it really is it's a win-win for everyone. It's a win for the town. It's a win for the state, the federal government. And frankly, it's a win for the developers as well, because they're now what we didn't want to get into was just a period of delays and unpredictability about whether or not certain areas of land were ever going to be developed because of potential habitats that may exist in those areas. And so by being proactive and setting aside these habitable areas around town, it gives both certainty to the developers that they can move forward with their projects, but also it gives certainty to the federal government and to the state government that we're also setting aside areas of land where, you know, we can move these species into.
So the town did approve a memorandum of understanding with Fish and Game to manage an 80-acre habitat, I think, for rabbits.
I believe that was around the size, Laura, and there were two separate agreements. One was with the town and one was with the school district.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah. My understanding is that the school district did not approve that memorandum, though I understand that, you know, there's still talks that are ongoing, and I don't fully know the details as to why the school was hesitant to enter into that agreement. As you probably are aware, the towns and schools and most municipalities are two completely different entities. But certainly from a town side and the land that we owned that was in conservation, we were willing to partner with Fish and Game and allow them to manage certain areas. And I think as talks move forward with the school district, I think eventually they'll be able to reach a point of agreement as well.
Kevin, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Laura, my pleasure. Thanks again.
Kevin Smith, Londonderry Town Manager, a community, again, which has looked at this question, as we heard, including in the case of rabbit habitat. And John Cantor, were you involved in that issue in Londonderry concerning rabbit habitat and the schools and concerns that people had about having too many rabbits near the schools?
Absolutely, I was, yes. And myself and working with our director, Glenn Normando, and Heidi Holman from my staff, who runs the conservation efforts for the New England cottontail, were all involved and worked very closely with the town. And when we're talking about the kind of what we've worked out here is, first of all, we have the largest known New England cottontail population left in New Hampshire after losing about 75% of our New England cottontail population. There's some in the seacoast, and then there's this in this highly, developing landscape near the airport around Stonyfield Yogurt. There is still this kind of stronghold of New England cottontails for New Hampshire. So the thing with cottontail habitat is it is moving around on the land because they like dense young forest and shrubby habitats. And so that comes after a place floods, comes after a fire burns an area, that comes after a disturbance of some kind. So you can't just set aside land and say, this is good rabbit habitat.
And stay here, rabbits.
You have to get it into the dense young shrub in young forest growth that they need. And that's what we're doing. We're going to the parcels that are conserved in Londonderry that are south of the developed areas. And we are working with their forester, with their conservation commission members to lay out areas where, we will in some cases cut trees to encourage young forest growth, to encourage shrub growth.
So what's the broader message from that experience in Londonderry for, everybody in New Hampshire? Some forests are worth cutting, some shrubs are worth preserving, or what?
The diversity of habitats is the key to diversity of wildlife, and that there isn't one size all fits all. Much of the forest that we have growing around, although our state has reforested, it is all a lot of what we would call mid-successional, kind of the same age forest. And that's not how the landscape would naturally look. We need to restore it back. Especially when you consider something like the New England cottontail that is native to this region. If we don't do something for it, it's going to go extinct.
Again, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Steve on Plum Island. He says, in my experience, when it comes to environmental protection, it depends on where the protective measures will be employed. For instance, when the spotted owl was up for protection in Oregon, i.e. far away, most in my community in Newburyport were all for it. But when U.S. Fish and Wildlife closed the federal beach on Plum Island, many local people were up in arms. In fact, they still are. Steve said it is much easier to champion wildlife when it is far away, not in your own backyard. It's a very interesting point. What do you think, Amanda?
Well, you know, something that's important to focus on is, and just to give an example here, in the Wildlife Action Plan, there are 169 species of greatest conservation need. So those are the species that are in serious trouble. They're losing habitat, declining in numbers. And so when habitat is being protected for those species, it's being protected for the broader suite of species beyond just the 169 that are in the Wildlife Action Plan. And so what we actually are seeing a lot of communities in the state are doing, we have some communities like Londonderry protecting habitat specifically for cottontails. We see other communities who are being proactive in protecting habitats that may be unique in their community, floodplain forests, for example. We don't have a lot of floodplain forests left. That's often a significant habitat they'll look at protecting. So by protecting some of these key habitats that are listed in the Wildlife Action Plan, there's 27 of these critical habitats that are kind of at-risk habitats. We have a much better chance of protecting habitat for a broad range of species. So we have kind of both sides of the coin there, where there may be specific habitat for a specific species, but also looking at that bigger picture as well.
Well, and make the connection for us, Nick, if you could please, between protecting habitat for whatever you want to talk about, you know, beavers and possible wolves and cottontails and our species, the human race. I mean, it's not just about making things nice for bunny rabbits.
Well, you know, I think what's important for a lot of communities, conservation commissions in particular, that are working on this, is that they really start with what is important in our community. So a natural resources inventory is a great place to start, to really start to list out what are the things that are highest value for our community that we can practically take care of. And so that's why the Wildlife Action Plan is so important, is because it identifies those critical habitats. And I think there's a real concern about fragmentation of habitats, and it's a very real problem for sure.
Fragmentation of habitats means just sort of the land is cut up. It's a little bit here, a little bit here, but it's not practical.
Right. So I'll give you an example in the town that I live in. We have limited resources, and we really thought that protecting the river in our community was important. And we decided to protect the river because of the potential for development, which we didn't think was appropriate, and also for the potential of restoration of habitat. And so there's a co-benefit there because we think a clean river is going to provide good tourism opportunity. It's going to provide clean water for our community, which is obviously a benefit to the residents, but also at the same time protects important resources for critters.
So. Okay. All right. We will follow up after a short break. A lot more of your phone calls and emails. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the state's new 10-year wildlife action plan and what it says about balancing the needs of animals and people in the Granite State. We want you to call in 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Find us on Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Eric that came in. He says, kudos to New Hampshire Fish and Game and many partners on the Wildlife Action Plan. Great work. Eric says, to help help advance this work and safeguard New Hampshire wildlife requires robust funding. Eric asks, what can citizens do to encourage policymakers to provide adequate funding for the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department? This is a very interesting question, one we've spent a lot of time talking about in the exchange. What do you think, John? Adequate funding. Fish and Game is funded mostly by federal monies and fees, hunting and fishing fees.
Correct. And within the department, the Non-Game and Endangered Wildlife Program, which I supervise, is funded by Moose Plate money, private donations. We get up to $50,000 of general fund money and then federal money. Those resources, to the tune of about $500,000 a year from those federal state wildlife grants, which come through the budget and are the onus for putting together the wildlife action plan. So, that's a tenuous way and not enough to provide the resources for people to make good decisions about wildlife that is out there. And so, there are numerous mechanisms, everything from, expanding some kind of tax or fee onto outdoor equipment that would then
go to the kayak
tax.
We've talked about that.
Yeah, at the federal level, because I think a lot of people might not understand that, like, for our sport fish and game wildlife, there is a federal tax on all guns and ammunition and fishing equipment that is then goes back to the states for research and management and education of those species. But there isn't a corollary thing for things that aren't hunted or fished. So that's provided a long-term dedicated source of funding for some species since the 1930s. We need some kind of long-term dedicated funding source in place. Maybe it's oil and gas lease fees. Or there's lots of other formulas for putting that together, but we do need those resources. Right now we are awfully thankful to the folks who buy moose plates and the folks who donate to the Non-Game and Endangered Wildlife Program to keep us going.
Thanks for the email, Eric. And let's go back to our callers. Anne's calling from Mason. Hi, Anne. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Thank you. Laura, it's nice to be on today. I wanted to ask, in southern New Hampshire and across this region, we're impacted by the proposed Kinder Morgan pipeline, which is proposed to go across a lot of conservation land, water, and impact the environment greatly. How do you see this report helping us to establish what amount of mitigation would be appropriate, and what are your thoughts on the actual ability to mitigate the destruction that the pipeline would create?
And thank you for the question. And okay, so here's another example of, you've got this new report, the 10-year Wildlife Action Plan. You have these big projects that some people want to build. How do you take that plan, as Anne asks, Nick, and make it relevant for this project?
So we've been getting a lot of questions about the pipeline, about Northern Pass. So we've put together some fact sheets. And the first recommendation is to get comfortable with the Wildlife Action Plan. Immediately, again, it tells you where are those critical habitats, where are those most important resources that are important to your community and at the regional level and at the state level. So I think that's the first thing, is to really start to get comfortable with the plan to understand what are those important resources. The next thing is to really think as a town, this is where the Conservation Commission comes in, is, where is it appropriate to protect? Where is it appropriate to mitigate? So the best impact is no impact. So avoidance whenever possible. So looking back at those plans, where are the places that can be avoided? And then where there are impacts that are potentially unavoidable, how do we essentially mitigate for them? And that could be things like restoration of another area. It can be things like paying into the in-lieu fee fund. I think what we're trying to do with the Conservation Commissions as this process unfolds is really to be making your decisions in a scientific way. So not just about, well, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad, but scientifically, methodically working through the process. And the first place to start is the Wildlife Action Plan.
So when a company wants to build a pipeline or, again, a 10-apartment housing unit or a shopping mall or whatever, it takes this wildlife action plan into account, Nick, or it does if it wants to, but it doesn't really have to. I guess my question is somebody saying to a developer, you have to take this into consideration, or we hope you will take this into consideration?
Well, it's a yes and no answer. So the RSA that established conservation commissions, there are two real things that that give them some teeth, if you will. One is that they are required to basically manage the resources in their community appropriately. So identifying those resources and then having an inventory, understanding where those important resources are, and then working with the developer to say, you know, this is not an appropriate impact. We don't believe this is an appropriate impact because of these resources. One of the other things that conservation commissions have the ability to do, and they're the only municipal body that can do this, is to put an administrative hold on a wetlands impact application. So if a application comes through, the conservation can say, wait a minute, time out. We need a little more time to investigate what this impact will be, whether it's appropriate.
And wetlands are important because, I mean, we've talked about it a little bit, but just remind us, they have broad impacts on human and animal life.
Well, they're the cradle of life, in especially with when it comes to wildlife. So that's where life begins. And, you know, if we're destroying those habitats, then we are putting our community in serious danger. And they also have very important qualities for water quality in the community.
Mitigating flooding and so forth. All right, let's take another call. Thank you for that one, Anne. And Wendy's in Guilford. Hi, Wendy, you're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hey, Laura, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The point I wanted to make is in terms of the 10-year plan and looking at families, and I was a teacher for many years, and we take the children out in the woods, and it always shocked me how many of them were never outdoors unless the times we took them out. And if you want communities and families to support endeavors to protect the environment, there's got to be a meaningful and personal connection. There's a quote, and I don't know if it's Robert Pyle or David Sobel, but said, how can you get kids to care about the fate of the condor when they haven't made the acquaintance of the wren in the backyard?
Wow.
So looking at, and I love that quote, because when we're looking at our communities, our state, and having people literally care about what's happening, then there's got to be that personal connection with wildlife, that personal connection with what's happening in the natural world.
Well, Wendy, thank you so much for calling. And, you know, this is a huge issue. We've done entire hours on what some people, Amanda, call nature deficit disorder.
Right.
Remember that term. What do you think about what Wendy says? Thank you so much, Wendy.
Well, you know, we're seeing a lot of communities already starting to focus more on getting youth involved and getting them outdoors. We have several schools in the state, one in my hometown and an adjacent town, that actually have conservation land adjacent to the school that the biology teachers are using to take their students out into and really using that outdoor classroom. And there are kids who are getting out there that haven't really, you know, here we are in New Hampshire with all these open spaces, but haven't spent a lot of time outdoors, particularly in this day and age of technology and being glued to our tablets and our smartphones. So it's we're seeing a really strong move, both on the part of the schools and on the part of communities and conservation commissions who are doing programming to try to bring more youth into that. So I think we're going to see an increase in that, particularly with some of the outreach programs that communities are doing. They've discovered that going outdoors, taking people outside rather than sitting indoors and listening to a presentation, not that those are bad, there's some great presentations, but getting families outdoors is a great way to really span that range of ages. Parents coming out with their kids, they're all outdoors in the morning, they're learning things about wildlife and habitats. The kids think it's really cool if they see a snake and somebody picks it up and shows them how to hold it. So, you know, I think there's a lot of great experiences there. And I think we're going to see more of that as we move into the second 10-year period of the Wildlife Action Plan with more people getting involved.
So does the Wildlife Action Plan talk about that, you know, one-on-one engagement?
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. We had these public input sessions as part of the Wildlife Action Plan to sort of help to shape it. And we heard it very strongly from the participants at those sessions. We had, I think it was something like 169 people from 79 communities. And we heard very strongly, we need to get more schools involved. We need to get the kids involved. We need to get families involved. So I think we will be seeing that a lot more. And we have that incorporated into the actions that we have in the Wildlife Action Plan.
Well, thank you very much for that call, Wendy. And following up on Anne's question about the pipeline development, here's an email from Craig who says, can't pipelines and power utility easements create the habitat that rabbits and other emergent forest species prefer? Emergent forest, John, you talked about that earlier, meaning sort of the scrubby newer forest. What do you think about this question?
Answer to that question is absolutely in the right places they can. And we work very closely, have worked closely with PSNH, now Eversource. And there are several portions of cottontail populations that do occur on the power line right away, working on the way that they, you know, the timing of their cutting of their vegetation and stuff in those areas is a key to habitat protection. So they do provide some important habitats on the landscape. They need to be managed correctly if it's all flattened down to grass at one time. but by keeping a mosaic of shrubs on the land, they could be valuable habitats.
Did you want to jump in on that, Nick?
I was just going to add, a lot of it depends on how they manage it as well. So, for example, if they're using pesticides and they're using herbicides, then that's problematic. And so those are questions that conservation commissions and municipalities should be asking these energy companies.
That's a good point, because the Wildlife Action Plan talks especially about the threat to bees from herbicides and pesticides. And if bees aren't doing their job, then, you know, they're not pollinating our food, which is kind of crucial for us.
Correct.
So is there a way to do it without herbicides and pesticides? Just go in there and cut? I remember once PSNH, back in the old days, had a sheep plan. I think they went in and munched through the corridors. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong there, Nick. Well,
goats are great.
Goats.
I've seen communities manage poison ivy with goats. That's sort of silly answer, but I think absolutely these companies are multi-billion-dollar companies. They figured this stuff out.
Okay, well, and just to finish up with all of you, we just have a couple minutes left, and there's so much in this plan that we won't get to. But John, to you, we've talked a lot about habitat. We've talked about balancing, you know, development with the needs of certain animals here in New Hampshire. What about animal disease? Does the report talk about that? Because we've heard some scary stories about, you know, white-nosed bats and so forth.
Yes, absolutely. A couple of the key threats that are addressed. One is disease. Climate change is certainly one that is going to affect all wildlife. The fate of some of our most common mammal species, like little brown bats, northern long-eared bats. There was a fungus many folks have heard of called white nose, that manifests itself as white nose syndrome, probably introduced by cave explorers bringing, you know, the spores of this fungus from Europe to over here. There's the interaction of wildlife with the air and water and habitats is complex, and we need to think about how the spread of diseases, by the movement of people and global goods, is affecting the health of wildlife as well. And it gets into some complicated areas, but I think through good science, through working with folks that have a handle on this through looking at human disease spread and stuff, that we can also think about how some of these non-habitat related issues can be dealt with at meaningful scales. So.
Amanda, how much is climate change kind of overriding all the work that's in this this plan?
Right. Well, as we know, climate change is a big issue with the talks in Paris right now. And in terms of, impacts on New Hampshire, yes, we are going to see some shifts in habitats. The best thing we can do is protect the land that we have for the future, because that's going to build more resilience into the landscape. It's going to enable us as people, because we live in habitat too, and wildlife, to adapt to changes in climate. If we just develop indiscriminately, we're going to be at the losing end. But if we can protect those larger tracts of habitat so we maintain the natural hydrology of the landscape, which avoids flooding, which impacts us and our homes, but it also impacts wildlife in terms of those changes to their habitats on a shorter-term scale. But we're going to see changes in vegetation over the years as we project ahead. So it's definitely an issue we need to take into consideration in terms of protecting habitats for the future.
Do you want to jump in, Nick Coates? One last thought from you before we close out on what you hope comes out of this Wildlife Action Plan.
Well, you know, as a former planner, I think the most important thing is good planning, and starting with good data is the critical part of all of this. So to really understand what's going on in your community is the first step. And then from there, using the tools that are available to you as a community, so things like potentially acquiring land, things like managing town forests in an active way. You know, we haven't even talked about pollinator habitats, which are another important part of all of this, is just to think about how these habitats can be protected while also having managing working land. So I think starting with good information and then making will lead to good decisions.
And speaking of information, there are a couple relevant websites, some really cool maps. We'll put those right on our website, nhpr.org/exchange.
Yes, and they can just go to takingactionforwildlife.org and get all the information they need off there.
Okay, and John, I can see you want to jump in. One last thought.
Going back to one of the earlier calls or emails about engaging folks, most of the data on the distribution and abundance of wildlife comes to us through volunteers reporting. What a way to engage schools, the communities. We need help. We don't have the staff to go out there and inventory and look for this wildlife. What a way to engage people. We need them to help us get this information consolidated into a way that we can use it for, very good land planning decisions.
So go out there and count rabbits.
Count bumblebees, look for butterflies. Volunteer program that Audubon did on dragonflies as a part of the first Wildlife Action Plan. Wonderful new information about a whole group of organisms that we didn't have before, mostly collected by volunteers.
All right. Thank you all very much for being here. Really appreciate it. John, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
John Cantor is supervisor at New Hampshire Fish and Game. Amanda, it was good to meet you. Thank you for being here as well.
Great to be here.
Amanda Stone, she's with UNH Cooperative Extension. And Nick Coates, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Nick Coates, executive director at the New Hampshire Association of Conservation Commissions. This is The Exchange on NHPR.